Welcome back to Pacific Novel Project with Jason and Steve, the podcast where we write things and then give them each other to make fun of.
Pretty much.
Today, well, as always, every day almost, we're talking about our books, The Hollywood Dreams by Steve Childress and The Ghost of Silver Creek by me, Jason Peterson, aka Jason Keith. And we're on draft two. We've done our shitty first drafts, which you can find on our website at patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project. And you can also find our Bring Your Own Book Club podcast there too, which is specifically for subscribers, filled with brilliant insights and snarky witticisms. So this week we are starting out with Hollywood Dreams. I have been directed to read the purple text. All right, so last we left off, we're in Lou's tomb and Monty. We're talking to Abbott about the case, hoping to figure out a way to identify the girl that came up with the scheme to release information to the press and see if that'll draw any family members out to give them a positive ID to honor. You picked up where we left off in Lou's, and that was just a couple lines of conversation. I didn't really say anything there. And this is on page 51. So then we go to Tomb in his car. This section is entitled Tomb's Bucket, which I thought was kind of funny. He's no place in particular. He's just roaming around. So in the first paragraph, I just had a couple editing suggestions. Yeah, kind of a long sentence about the engine running all eights down the Kahanga Pass, which I think I pronounced correctly, and onto Highway 101 with the window down, air sweeping across the car, in the car across my face. It was just all kind of wordy. I think we've all been in cars. We know what happens when the window's down. So I just made that two sentences and just had, I had the window down and the cool night air swept across my face. I think that should be sufficient. I highlighted a couple places where you had hooch close together and two places leaving 51 and going on to 52. Two sentences next to each other where you wrote one of the few to start out a couple sentences close together. So he's driving along, he's thinking, he's kind of having flashbacks. He's having flashbacks to hooch running. He's having flashbacks to ambulance driving, and he's thinking about drinking. I like this line you have here. I come upon a slow moving cargo truck and watch it for a bit and let the memories crawl up like a vine around my mind and strangle any other thoughts. That was a really cool and telling image. Perhaps now that I'm looking at this again, when you say come upon a slow moving cargo truck, do you mean like driving up behind one?
Yes.
Maybe like say I tail it for a bit.
All right. I can make that more clear.
Yeah, watching it just kind of sounds like, oh, I'm watching a truck. Yeah, so he talks, and then there's this paragraph, it has a little flashback to World War I ambulance driving. And what I thought was interesting about this was the way it ended, that section ended. He's like talking about tomb. He's talking about drinking and desire to drink, but then he stops to get coffee. Don't recall any part in this story yet where he's making that effort to stop drinking yet.
Right. Yeah.
So that was kind of an interesting part. I mean, I know he's had a little chat with Anna, but it hasn't been super prevalent, at least not like in the first draft, since you've added stuff in and have kind of spaced stuff out. So bottom of page 52, we're back at Wilcox Station. Monty is sitting in there, and Tomb comes in and slams the door. He's not expecting it and scares him. Nothing to say there. 53. I didn't say anything on 53. They're just talking about the newspaper article that's come out, hoping it'll work. Somebody calls Tomb, and it is Grady. I was going to ask you when we're going to have another Grady appearance, because I didn't think you were eliminating him from the story completely. I thought you were just downplaying him just a touch.
It's been kind of hard to squeeze him in a lot of other scenes, so I'm just trying to squeeze him in where I can for now.
Yeah, I don't need or want a ton of Grady.
Fair enough.
I thought this was a good play. To me, he's just a minor character. Maybe just work him in. Just remind us who he is. Like this good spot right here where he's on the phone. You know, he's buddies with Tomb. You know, he's the black flatfoot who Tomb likes and thinks is smart but won't be a detective because he's, you know, police force racist. So he's got a hot tip. He says, you and Monty should come down to Gagliardi Warehouse because there's some stuff happening. Yeah, and so I think things like this are great, just us reminding who he is. And then as you work him in, if that's your plan, to have him more involved with their present case if they need him for something. So that's the end of page 53. And then we go to page 54. Granny says, a guy found three bodies in the Gagliardi warehouse freezer, frozen solid. One of them has a broken watch fob on his suit vest and a photo of your Jane Doe and some other woman in his pocket. I like where this is placed in the story. I like the transition that gets them to be involved in the case instead of it just them being called to it, you know, like in the previous version, I think just like a couple days later, because it seemed too soon for them to pick up another case that just happened to be related to theirs. Yeah, I like this transition. I was wondering if they are getting this as a tip. It seems like maybe there's some other detectives involved or something. And how would they react to that? But when they get there, you know, it is just Abbott. So anyway, that was just a question I had. What about detectives who are actually on the case? But
well, I'll probably add something in later. I didn't really think about it at the time. But it's a good thing to look at.
So Gagliardi Warehouse, they get there. Just a little editing suggestions. The first line, just to tighten up. That was all. Oh, and I deleted this. I say pulling my cigarette and lighting it. I just kind of deleted it and lighting it because we know he lights it. I mean, we're on page 54. We know he's lighting cigarettes. It's news if he doesn't light it.
Fair enough.
And then it just gets you away from over-explaining everything. Page 55, I just suggested some deletes that I think were just extra words that you didn't need in the sentence. I changed tied up to... What did I do there? Yeah, so I deleted... You said he was tied up and his hands were lashed. Well, if his hands are lashed, he's tied up. And I like the word lashed better than tied up, so I deleted tied up and suggested leaving lash there. And that was it for page 55, page 56. This is all kind of, I mean, the scene's old to me, but all the stuff that's happening in it is completely brand new. So the first roll through, I don't have too much to say. 56, it said the ice crystals make it look freezer burned. And it was talking about the pools of frozen blood. So I said them, since you said pools. If you said pool, I think it would have been correct.
Right, yeah, true.
Although... Further in, the two bodies lay in pool. Did you change the description of the bodies?
A little bit.
Okay, a little. I feel this is less creepy than the first version.
Oh, okay. Well, I might have to re-up the creepy value.
Now, yeah, because if I remember the first version, I think the issue with the first version was he like walks in there and says it's a nightmare. And then he just starts talking about other stuff. And then you get the description of the bodies. In this one, the descriptions of the bodies is a little more mild and different. I don't know. Maybe take a look at that last. You know, I really liked the descriptions of the bodies in the last one. I really liked.
Okay.
In this one, I didn't feel like I got as much of a description of the scene as I did in the other one.
All right. I'll go back and take a look at the other draft and see what I did different there.
Man, it's still a crazy scene. So these guys from your first draft, when you had swapped to that third person stuff, are these guys still killed by the German dude?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not sure who it's going to be yet because I've been doing some more research and I want to include some more kind of historical points about actual people involved with Murphy Ranch and the Nazi Bund in LA. So I got to figure out how I'm going to work that in and who I want end up being Mortimer or if Mortimer's going to stay.
For those listening, it's Buns with a D, B-U-N-D-S, not Buns. Which is what I keep thinking of when I hear that word.
Right? Totally.
Love those Nazi buns.
Oh, God.
Are we talking about butts or pastries? I don't know. I don't care. Love them.
If they're Nazi buns, would they be strudels?
Probably.
All right.
Okay. Or, and do they have those meat pies, or is that just the Brits?
I don't know. Good question.
Well, the things we want to know. Hey, yeah, research that, because you don't have enough research to do for this already.
Oh, no, I have not near enough research to do.
So we got the scene, which is a guy in a chair and who's been beaten up to death and shot. And then two of Danny DeLuca's, they're still DeLuca's guys, right?
Yep.
Were shot. And I know what happened in this scene because I read the first version that was in third person. And these two guys were torturing this one dude who was German. And then some other Germans came in and just killed everybody. Now they're at this thing going, what the hell happened? I think it's a lot more mysterious than this way, because you're just like the police, like, what the hell is happening here? And they find the Luger, and the reason Grady brought them down was because the fob of the watch matches. It's a broken fob without a watch, and they have a watch that matches it, which they'd found on Elsa earlier. So that's why Grady called them down here. And Abbott's like, what the hell are you doing down here? Well, we got a little tip. This might, should be, could be related to our case. All right, so they identify these guys as DeLuca's, Danny DeLuca, Toom's old friend, on page 57, top of page 57. And then, of course, we go back to Lou's tavern, and they're telling him, they're discussing, I love that they discuss police business with Lou all the time. So it just opens up, what do you mean he's frozen solid? So I like the transition. I thought that was funny. Lou's asking this question while he pouring some bourbon. I thought this was interesting. What exactly what it sounds like, Lou? Fucking frozen stiff, Monty says, picking up his beer. Now, I know I've had issues with Monty writing Toom about his drinking problem because I feel like he's the new guy and he's not going to quite get to that level yet, especially in the 1940s police force. There are probably all a bunch of leshes. So I find it interesting because I feel that Monty is doing more drinking in this version. And I'm wondering, are you going in the opposite direction with him? Are you going to turn him into an alky? What's going on with Monty and all his drinking?
Yeah, I'm taking Monty in a little bit different direction in this draft. I want to not make him so straight-laced, being that I'm not going to make him an FBI plant in the LA, in the LA task force as a detective, if you will. Okay. So I think I'm going to kind of just see where he goes organically. And I mean, being that he's going to be in Lou's with Toom, I mean, I don't see him getting like super drunky, but I mean, at least, you know, making the best of a situation, I guess.
All right. And then they're talking and Monty says, hey, can I get a couple of rocks, meaning ice? And Lou gives him a couple ice cubes. And I was like, oh, is he going to put ice in his beer? What kind of brick is Toom going to shit? And then it was even better. He just dumps him in Toom's ice, in Toom's bourbon, which I thought was really funny.
Awesome. Glad you liked that.
Yeah. I was expecting a little bit more of a harsh reaction from him, but, you know, he's like, all right, real cute kid, and starts reaching in and taking the ice cubes out. Page 58, they find out, oh, no, I guess Lou's just talking about, mentioned some guys were talking about Murphy Ranch, and Toom lets them know that he saw Nazi armband on the desk of one of the dudes at the apartment or hotel or whatever, and he didn't think of anything at the time, just thought the dude was a kook. But now he's wondering if there's something bigger going on. And Monty's like, oh man, we should, I picture this as like the late afternoon or early evening. And Monty's like, yeah, let's go do it. Let's go get him. I'm like, man, that guy's always in a hurry. Toom's like, come on, sit down, kid. We ain't got enough evidence to go rouse this dude in the middle of the night. We'll just take care of tomorrow. He's not going anywhere. I didn't have a lot to say on this page. I just commented that Monty's always in a hurry because it amused me. And then I had a comment on the last line of page 58 where he's talking about maybe it's a war starting between Siegel and Cohen, but those were Danny's guys. So I was kind of like, well, why wouldn't you think Danny was involved with that? Why is he picking these two random gangsters? I mean, I know they're, you know, big in LA at that time, but it was just a question. I don't.
Oh, well, if there was going to be a power play within the mafia world in LA at the time, I would see it being a falling out between Siegel and Cohen. Cause why aren't they starting?
Go ahead.
I don't know. It's just Toom kind of like making theories. I mean, cause you know, Danny, sure, but he's kind of a low level, a lower level guy, unless he thinks Danny's going to try to make a power play.
So, I don't know. That's why these are like two big guys. These are two big guys and Danny's a little guy and it's Danny's men who are there. So that just kind of took me out. Haven't mentioned these guys, but.
But Danny's guys are also their guys. Well, if Danny's under them, I mean, chain of command and all that.
Okay. You think Danny works for him? He's not independent? He money launders for them?
I mean, at the time, what better way to launder money than, you know, a B-level movie studio?
All right. Page 59, fourth line down. Am I reading that? Does that say the rallies went quiet a few years back?
Yes.
Okay. I don't. It wants to switch it to quite. I don't know why.
It wanted to do the same thing to me too.
Yeah, I'm sure we're seeing the same thing. If I switched to quite, it still wouldn't make any sense.
Right.
But it is a little odd wording. If you're referring to the Hindenburg Park and the rallies that went quiet a few, I would say if you're referring to the Hindenburg Park, those rallies went quiet a few years back.
Well, there was more rallies than just at Hindenburg Park, though.
Yeah. Well, it says here, and the rallies, multiple rallies. Anyway, not a big deal. Sentence is fine, I guess. Tomb, I think Nancy got herself mixed up in something really dark. Do they mean Nancy or Elsa? Because Elsa's the dead one.
Nancy's the dead one.
Oh, Nancy's dead?
Yes, Nancy's the dead one.
Oh, okay. Is that new? I thought Elsa was the dead one.
No, Elsa's the one that we haven't... I mean, unless I totally just, like, confused myself, which is possible. I'll have to go back and double check, but I thought I did. But I'll double check it.
Was Nancy the dead one in the first version?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I believe you. And that is all I have for the Hollywood Dreams.
Do you think it would make more sense if I had Tomb's theory, like, being if, like, Danny was making a power play against somebody?
I think him having any kind of theory about Danny would make more sense than those other guys.
I'll play with that and see it, you know, see how it works out.
Do they know the guy's the dead German who was beaten up? Do they know he's a German?
Shit.
I don't remember reading that. I just closed it out, otherwise I'd go back and look at it. I mean, they have the watch fob that's in the Luger, so I guess they're just making an assumption.
Assumptions, yeah. I mean, it's all conjecture at this point, but he does have the symbols and the presence of a German Luger round. I don't know. It throws some stuff into question, but definitely the pocket watch definitely is a symbol that, I don't know, you wouldn't be really wearing that around unless you really meant to, at least in my opinion anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, you ready for Ghost of Silver Creek?
Yep.
Okay. All right, so our second workshop story for the evening is returning to the Ghost of Silver Creek. Last we left off, we were with Joshua and Chalk as they were investigating the field surrounded by the wooded area where they find odd symbols burnt into the ground, the cut off ears, the knife, and they find a horsehair from Keela. Keela, right? Keela, Kyla?
Keela.
Keela, okay. And they find the horsehair from Keela, but no tracks. So we have like this mysterious ghost horse that doesn't leave tracks. And we leave off with them overlooking Charles Johnston's homestead. And they also see, Joshua sees a mysterious rider in a tree line as it's getting dark, but Chalk doesn't have any semblance of what Joshua had seen. Let's see here. Charles, Avis, and Elsa all go in the house, and we pick up with them having dinner together. And this is on page 54. I loved the scene with Avis just tearing into that goat leg without inhibition. And she catches Charles and Elsa just staring at her. And it's just like, I don't know, she just seemed feral in that moment. Like she was just starved for days and had no fucks to give. So I really liked that. There was in the beginning sentence, there was a moment that conjured an interesting image in my head. Nothing wrong with how it's written. It's just conjured an interesting image in my head. It was dinner was quite a fair. Charles had roasted meat from the goat he dressed earlier, and they ate in silence with boiled carrots and corn. And it was just with the boiled carrots and corn, I had this mental image in my head of like boiled carrots and corn sitting around the table with them looking all melancholy and being silent. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the sets. It was just, yeah, it was my own demented mind. So let's see. His lower lip was tucked in, and Avis had already come to recognize this as Charles' serious look. I liked the acknowledgement of body language and Avis already kind of picking up Charles's mannerisms. Kind of establishes that they're, you know, kind of getting to know each other, that you know, probably a rapport is starting to be established. So, yeah. Page 55. Okay. Page 55, down towards the bottom. From her place on high on the porch, Avis's eyes looked into the Palominos. That felt kind of passive to me. And yeah, with Avis's eyes looked into.
Okay.
So a little bit further down. At first glance, Avis thought she saw two moons reflected in his eyes. His eyes being the Palomino. I thought it was kind of an interesting development that she only sees Ina when she looks up into the night sky. Because she, I mean, does her amnesia have a bearing on kind of that seeing as believing or seeing as not always believing sentiment?
Yeah, I'm toying with this as part of her severed connection with the other world.
Okay. So she can't see the other moon because of that severed connection, and probably might be something that she builds back into, maybe.
I've also been toying with the idea that the moon she sees is the other moon, and the moon she's been getting her power from is the other moon.
Okay, so she...
And she just doesn't realize it.
Okay, so she's only seeing Pa or only seeing Ina, then?
She's calling it Ina.
She's calling it Ina, but it's...
Yeah.
But it would actually be Pa?
And maybe Ina the whole time is Pa, or maybe they're both the same moon, and it's just how you view it.
Ah!
Different things I've been thinking about.
Okay. I can go with that. It'll be interesting to see what you do with that. It makes me think of, there's four lights! There's four lights!
Four lights! man, yeah, it was just something that came to my mind right there that second while I was writing. Who knows?
Nice. I mean, I like it. I like the dynamic of it. I mean, because we're getting immersed into this world along with Avis. So I think with her separation, and we already know that she's like not of this world. But yeah, I think that'll be interesting to see how it develops. So let's see here, page 56. I thought the hesitant kind of start of a reach of Charles toward Keela was interesting. For me, it kind of spoke toward like a sense of awe or wonder that Charles might have with there actually being a real horse in front of him. And actually having this opportunity to like see a real horse in a world without horses. And I almost kind of wondered if like the horse kind of almost has like a kind of a sacred kind of feel to, you know, to him in a way that makes him weary of actually wanting to connect with it. I don't know. Did you get any of that?
Yes, I heard it all.
Okay, cool.
I was thinking if I should say something or not. We probably should, just so you know that you're not talking to yourself.
Right. I mean, just in this case, I guess, since we're having such problems with the fucking audio.
I would say yes. That's kind of the feeling I was trying to portray.
Okay, cool. I'm glad I read that right or well or interpreted it, you know, in a similar manner. Okay, section 13. I didn't have anything to say in the first part at the bottom of the page. So on to page 57. This is section 13. I didn't have much to say at the first part of the section on the previous, where it starts on the previous page at the bottom. But 57 here, Elsa is kind of peeking up over the floor, standing on the ladder to the loft, kind of watching Avis. And Avis catches her watch, you know, kind of just curiously kind of watching her. I liked this voice descriptor, which was her voice timid as if she were caught sneaking sweets before supper. Just that kind of timidity in the tone. It just had a good feeling to it, and it gave a lot of character to kind of how she was in that moment and kind of how the high she says comes out. So yeah, I liked that. Okay, I didn't have anything on the rest of 57, so down to 58. I really liked the dialogue between Elsa and Avis through pretty much the whole rest of this this series of pages. It felt very natural in their progression and kind of very natural in developing a rapport or even the start of what could be considered a friendship. This is when Avis tries on the dress that Elsa brings up to her. And it fits her perfectly, but it's like, it's not her. And first Elsa's like, well, it looks great. And then she's like, and she coaxes the truth out of her. And she's like, well, you know, you look pretty, but it just doesn't suit you. So I thought that was kind of verbal joust, if you will, between pleasantries and, you know, kind of coaxing the truth out of her. A little further down, a little past halfway, there was a sentence that took me out. It was, today with another night's rest and Charles fortifying in her belly, she felt renewed vigor. It kind of made me think that she ate Charles.
Oh, yeah, or maybe Charles was giving her something.
Oh, God. Well,
It's supposed to be meal, fortifying meal.
That's what I thought it was supposed to be, but yeah, I was like,
All right, I'll check that out.
All right, cool.
Semen.
Oh boy. Well, she does like Charles with the shirt off, so you know, anything's possible. Avis is going to hell. She's got impure thoughts about Charles. Okay, down to 56.
56? 59.
59.
We're on 58.
Okay. Wow, I totally transposed that number. So 59, thank you.
Okay.
I didn't really have much on this page except for down at the bottom. I liked the scene between Avis and Elsa milking the cows and Elsa trying to teach Avis how to do it. And this is some of this was in the previous draft. And it was... And again, I mean, just so the previous draft, I liked Avis like kind of failing at this thing. I mean, it's just like she's not a quick study to it, and it kind of makes her not perfect. And I like that because she's elvish. She's not of this plane of existence anymore. So I mean, she kind of, and people think that she was a ghost. So I mean, she kind of has like this fantastical quality about her, but yet she's just as susceptible to failure as anybody else. So that's, yeah. So I liked this scene with her and Elsa.
Cool.
All right, down to 61. I thought this was an interesting word choice, and it was, then she heard the hateful sound of milk ringing on the side of a pail. And I was like, oh, Avis is a little green. Just totally like jealous, like she can't do it, you know, but here's little Elsa, you know, just milking away.
Yeah, is this after she's already like in pain and stuff? Yeah.
Okay, so a little bit further, Ava says, by the moons, or no, she doesn't say it, but she thinks it, by the moons, Ava's thought, the strength in that child. Yeah, I see you already saw my comment, but so she knows of a second moon, but couldn't see it in the night sky, or at least not see it in this planet, on this plane of existence.
Yeah, I don't know, whatever.
Okay, yeah, I know you kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, but yeah. So if you wanna speak on that at all, go for it, man.
Yeah, I don't have anything to say about that.
Okay, cool, fair enough.
I added a new comment.
Oh, I think I like that one better. That's good. I have to say it. I have to say it. By Ida's tits! Avis thought. The strength in that child. Oh, that's rich. I like it.
Thanks. I probably won't go with it.
Okay, a little bit further down on the same page. The sun had risen fully above the mountain, and the Palomino, with his head raised high, looked like a bronze statue. Though his head was tilted in a less graceful way, as if he were trying to understand what Avis was doing. I liked that image of Kilo with the sun, and it kind of, I don't know, it had a beauty about it that kind of made Kilo seem like really significant, not only to Avis, but as a horse in a horseless world. Almost as like Kilo was like his own effigy. Okay, page 62. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Page 62. Didn't have a whole lot on this page, just some very minor letter edits. I did like some of the foreshadowing that was done with how Elsa talks about James Jr., which is the McCann boy.
McMahon.
Oh, McMahon. Yeah. McMahon, thank you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you've missed our fun in the previous episodes about how many different names this family's got.
They had quite a few.
So I went, oh man, McMahon, McCann, McDermott, all the mix were in there. All the mix were in the mix.
It was great though.
All right, so I'm going with McMahon.
Okay.
Because I had that scene with the brand that looks like double M's.
Yes, that's right.
And then somebody's like, hey, you know, it's not W's or E's or something or whatever it was.
I know, right? It's all about perspective. So James Jr. or JJ is the son of Francine, which is a neighbor down the way that Elsa and Charles take the milk to. And she makes cheese and she has three girls and JJ to take care of. And she's a widow as her husband was killed a few to six months before the war ended. And I liked the history that gets alluded to with James telling Charles about his home in the mountains above the small outpost of Silvertip and how Charles, his wife, and Elsa pack up and go and homestead after the war. But it was kind of sad that James didn't get to go home. So it's also kind of a character builder for Charles and Elsa that Charles takes time out of his day or time out of his week or every couple days to take this milk over to kind of help out Francine and James's kid, Francine and James's kids, as well as Francine herself. So yeah, it was a good character development builder. You know, just through backstory. Let's see here, page 63, the top. Charles packed up his wife and 7-year-old daughter the moment he came home and headed to Silvertip. I kind of got taken out here and there on some of these details because it kind of goes back and forth between like Elsa telling Avis things, but I mean, some of it's in dialogue and some of it's kind of in summary. And then some of it goes to narration. I mean, was 7-year-old daughter just used to kind of like set a time reference?
Yeah, it's just, well, I didn't want to go token and have like 25 pages of straight dialogue.
Right, that's fair.
So I've intermixed the dialogue with just summary narratives, I guess you'd say, of the things she talked about from the third person perspective. And you know, just the things that she is telling Avis. So, you know, she's not saying, you know, Charles and the 7-year-old daughter, who's me, you know, packed him and left. You know, she's probably saying, yeah, so Pa packed us up and headed out west. Is probably what she would say. But I just wrote it this way for the narrative.
That's fair. It just, yeah, it took me out a couple times. But yeah, I see what you're doing there. Let's see here, a little further down the page. Avis again noted the difference in Elsa's voice when she talked about James Jr. This time it sounded like pride, as if JJ was part of her family or something more. And again, I like the foreshadowing that's occurring during these moments with Elsa and Avis, because I mean, we're getting a sense of community, even though we haven't met any of the McMahons yet. So yeah, I thought this was some good developments, good vehicle to carry, helping us get acclimated to this world, and more specifically, like this particular region of it, of the Nesters and who the Nesters are. And a little further down on page 63, the Johnsons and McMahons had become fast friends. Elsa and Martha helped Francine as best they could with chores. The little ones were too young to perform yet. 2 years after they had moved to the valley, Martha died of fever. That was almost 3 years ago. Charles had quit building their new home and had grown even more quiet. Going days sometimes without a word passed between them. And then Avis comes back with, "That sounds lovely."
Lonely.
Oh, lonely. Sorry. I totally read that wrong. That sounds lonely.
Did you read it lovely the first time you read it?
No, it was just,
okay.
It was an instance just in this moment.
Okay. Cause I was thinking, man, he must have thought that was weird.
Well, I did just then, but then I was like, oh, the last piece of dialogue we get from Elsa is, when we got here, Elsa said, "Francine's boy, JJ, was 9 and running the farm. Pa left him to it. You know, he was younger than me, but still the man of the house." And then we get narration that I don't see as Elsa saying any of this, and just the way it's worded, I kind of just see it as narration myself. And then Avis's response of, "That sounds lonely." Is she talking about Elsa and Charles or James Jr.?
She's talking about Elsa being with her dad and not talking.
Okay. It was just kind of confusing for me because it feels very much like narration, but then it's also dialogue shared between them. It took me out.
Okay, I'll work on it.
So let's see, a little bit further down towards the bottom of the page, 63, Avis says, "Maybe it has something to do with those men from the other night," Avis suggested. The sadness in Elsa's eyes turned to anger. "Brodies," was all the girl said. The word was the sound of spit. And I liked that detail on her inflection because it had like a real kind of hate behind it, like wanting to drag their name through like broken glass. But yeah, I liked that inflection. And then let's see, and then at the bottom of the page, they returned the pails and stools to the barn, then stepped into the sun. Avis looked at the burned building. With looked, I don't know, at this point, after like getting like all this stuff and seeing this burnt out pile of rubble, I kind of wanted a little bit more from Avis there. And I almost wonder if there's a possibility and a stronger verb here to reflect on some possible emotion.
Okay.
That Avis could have while looking at it.
Yeah.
And knowing what she knows now and how hard this has been on Charles and her. Because, I mean, the burned out building kind of feels like Silvertip in a nutshell.
Okay.
And I had a little suggestion. Avis regarded the burned out structure as Elsa's story settled on her mind. Yeah, it was just, I thought regarded was could be an interesting use. I don't know. I just threw it out. Take it, leave it, whatever. I don't care. So page 64, "Did the Brodies do that?" Referring to the burned out structure. Elsa nodded and the woman asked why. And this is when we kind of get the story from Elsa's perspective of like what's going on and why there's all this contention between the Brodies and as far as Avis knows at this point, Charles's homestead, which she ends up finding, like she ends up finding out it's like all the whole group of people in this area, which are referred to as Nesters. And she's all, "What's a Nester?" And Elsa shrugged. I don't rightly understand it all. All I know is this is my home and no one cared. I lived here before a few months ago. And I said this before, but I like the immersion we're getting into this world and this whole entire section. But this section in particular, I kind of feel we're getting the immersion alongside Avis and through Elsa, which I dig. I like that we're getting Elsa's perspective, you know, kind of like the world through the eyes of a child. She doesn't quite understand everything, but she knows, she understands a lot more than maybe adults would give her credit for.
Yeah, like most kids.
Right? And I like that about Elsa. Again, some good character development in a dialogue-driven way. So, yeah, good job, man.
Thank you.
Down to 65. Charles has gone hunting. Could be back anytime or late. Avis suggests going on a ride. The girl squealed with delight, the memories of the Brodies temporarily pushed aside, and threw her arms around Avis. And I'm really liking how the relationship between Elsa and Avis is developing. Elsa, like the McCann children, have completely lost the chance to be children. Avis, at least for Elsa, seems to provide the distraction that lets Elsa have some of that carefree time, even if it's just like fleeting moments where they go on a ride together. I mean, because this whole scene, like, Elsa is so serious and so Charles-like. And then when Avis asks, well, if we are through with our chores, what would you say to a ride? The girl squealed with delight. And the memories of the Brodies just kind of like goes into a fog. It just, you know, it exits stage left, stage right even. That's the first time, I think, in this section where they're milking the cows ever since, you know, Avis wakes up, that Elsa kind of like exhibited the qualities of a carefree child. So, yeah, I liked that.
No, good. Thanks.
Yeah. No, Jason. Thank you.
Yeah, the next scene is them riding to the meadow. My last version, my first draft, this scene and the riding scene all happened on two different days. So with my change in the timeline, with her sleeping for that day, I've put them all in this one day.
I think I like this this version better. I mean, I like the last version well enough as well, but I like the changes that you've kind of put to that here with, yeah, kind of making this in a shorter timeline of how it comes down.
Cool. All right. I think that's it, isn't it? Unless you got something, are there any other questions or comments or?
I got one question. They're going to go on their ride, and I imagine Avis is going to take Elsa to the field.
Yes.
Is Joshua and Chalk going to be creeping on them?
They've already left. This is a new day.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was just wondering because there was the comment of like Joshua leaving the dagger there because he's like, oh, who, you know, she'll come back for it. So I thought they might be like, you know, kind of staking out the field maybe at some point.
Nah.
I guess not.
He was ready to go back to town.
Okay. Fair enough.
So after I'm done with that meadow scene, which is going to be quite a bit different since she's, you know, I mean, the last one she went to go investigate, but in this one she has, you know, that dagger and things will revolve around that dagger. So that'll be a little bit different. Then I'll go back to Joshua for what he did that day, today, thing that we're reading, which I think is going to be the scene where, man, I don't really remember what happens in that scene. It's the day where he sleeps with Caroline, but I don't remember all the other stuff that happens that day. Go look at it.
I think that was where Chalk comes by and he's like all talking into his ear and he kind of tells Chalk to get lost. I think it was shortly after that where they find the beach with the body in the book, isn't it? Wasn't that the same day in the previous draft?
I don't know. I think I'll have to look. I think that seems a little soon, but possibly.
It might be. I could be remembering it wrong. Yeah. It's very possible.
That's where Joshua comes to talk to him to give him news, and he's talking to Joshua, but he talks to Chalk in a way that makes it sound like he's talking to Caroline, so she doesn't know.
Okay, that sounds familiar as well. Yeah, I'll just look forward to seeing where you go from here.
All right. Oh, man, me too.
Right?
All right, that's it. thanks for listening, everybody. Remember to check out our Patreon, patreon.com/... Oh my God, what are we? patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project. We have a website, and it's... I haven't updated it because it's the hosting website for iTunes, and for some reason, iTunes is rejecting my submissions, even though we have another podcast, which is science fiction stuff, called Galactic Nomads, and iTunes accepting that stuff, no problem at all, so whatever, I'm trying to figure it out. But you can try and, but at some point we're going to be on iTunes, yay, and at some time, PacificNovelProject.com will be awesome. But until then, patreon.com/PacificNovelProject, and you can find all our podcasts there, no problem.
And Apple's a bunch of jerks, just saying.
You think all companies are a bunch of jerks?
Well, especially Apple.
Yeah, okay, love my phone though.
Ah, fair enough. Fair enough.
For this year that the battery's working.
I know, right? Yeah, I mean, they bloated my phone software so my battery would last a lot less longer. And then they lied about it. Then they got caught in the lie. And then they said, oh, well, we'll replace it for $50. Okay. Well, you intentionally, like, broke my phone pretty much.
Yeah. Well, at least it didn't blow up in your hand.
I'm still waiting for that.
All right. All right. Good day, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Have fun. Thanks for joining us.
And right on.